Am I correct that we have not begun this chapter yet?
No, we have
not. Okay. This is the middle chapter of the three for the unit. And it's called a tour of the cell because we're going to look at the various parts of the cell. Mostly their organelles, but other parts as well. And we'll get to that after this opening slide. But what this slide shows you is that although there is a range in cell size when you look at all cells of all organisms, it's not a huge range. Most cells are roughly the same size. This is a huge range in sizes, by the way. The scale is not linear. This is a logarithmic scale, so each step is 10 times bigger than the one below it. And it goes all the way from the size of atoms up to 10 meters. Well, cells are in here just below the ability for human eyes to see them unaided, which is why we need light microscopes to see them. And you could see them on the light microscopes in the lab here. You don't see all that much detail in them. To get a real detailed view of the organelles within cells, you need an electron microscope that has much higher resolution and higher magnification as well. Let's look at two. This shows you a cartoon cell and a photomicrograph corresponding to it. But this is which half of the dichotomy of cell types? Right, this is a prokaryotic cell because it doesn't have a nucleus. This is the most, probably the easiest way to tell that. But remember that prokaryotic cells not only don't have a nucleus, which is a membrane-bounded organelle, prokaryotic cells also don't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. And therefore, in a prokaryotic cell, not all of which look like this, but in any prokaryotic cell, whether it's a bacterium or an archaean, there is only one compartment, since those cells have only one membrane, the plasma membrane that every cell has to have. It really defines the cell. Everything inside that single membrane that a prokaryotic cell has is its one compartment. And all of that stuff collectively in that compartment is called what? What did I say that was called?
Cytoplasm?
Correct. The cytoplasm fills the compartment of a prokaryotic cell. Well, the cytoplasm is a mixture of things. It includes DNA. A prokaryotic cell does not have a true nucleus, but in a eukaryotic cell, in the nucleus is where you find the DNA. But the fact that there is no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell does not mean there is no DNA. A prokaryotic cell needs DNA for the same reason any other cell does. The DNA of a prokaryotic cell is not in its own compartment. It's part of the cytoplasm. I just want you to be careful with the word nucleoid, which means like a nucleus, right? The oid suffix means like. A nucleoid is just the region of the cytoplasm where you find the DNA, but it's still part of the cytoplasm. There are ribosomes in a prokaryotic cell, which are organelles, and we'll look at them in detail later in the chapter, but ribosomes are not membrane-bounded organelles, so it doesn't violate what I've told you before about prokaryotic cells not having membrane-bounded organelles. Little brown dots here are ribosomes, and they need ribosomes for the same reason that we eukaryotes do, which is to produce proteins. Now, a typical prokaryotic cell, in addition to the plasma membrane that it has, which is this one of these yellow colors, a typical one will have a thicker, stronger layer called the cell wall exterior to the plasma membrane, which keeps it from exploding, basically. And depending on species, there could be a capsule, which is a layer even outside of that, outside of the cell wall. This is kind of a catch-all picture. Not every prokaryotic cell is going to have every one of these features. But for instance, you see fimbriae on this, which is a plural of fimbria. each fimbria is one of these hair-like projections. And for cells that have those, they allow the cell to stick to a surface, like your tonsil, for instance. This cell is also a flagellated cell, meaning it has flagella, the plural of flagellum. A flagellum is a whip-like, tail-like structure that allows for propulsion. It is a locomotory device, in other words, meaning it functions for locomotion, which is movement of the organism from point A to point B. That's all I wanted to say about that one. Let's go on to three. In three, we are looking at just a little piece of a cell's plasma membrane. And we talked a little bit about the fact that phospholipids form bilayers automatically. Why do they do that? What is... That's right. What word do we use to describe the fact that a phospholipid is both hydrophilic and hydrophobic? Right?
Yeah, I'm not a pronouncer. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's amphipathic. Right. They are phospholipids are amphipathic molecules, which is why just with no life involved at all, they will automatically assemble into a phospholipid bilayer. A phospholipid bilayer, though, is not a complete plasma membrane. So the cell-like structures will form simply if you have phospholipids and water. And that's how those are the precursors to the first cells. But a living cell can't have only phospholipids in its bilayer. It also has to have other components, and chief among those other components are various kinds of proteins, which are what these purple things represent. Well, we'll take a much closer look at the at plasma membranes in the final chapter of the unit. It's dedicated to the plasma membrane. So let's go on to four now. And if you consider the fact that you all started out as a single cell, the zygote that was created when your father's sperm fused with your mother's egg, that was an invisibly small you, right? You were a single cell. Now you are much bigger. There are things bigger than we are, but compared to almost all the living things, we are much bigger. And that didn't happen because your single zygote, your single cell that you were as a zygote, grew into a adult-sized cell. That would have been impossible because of the important thing that's pointed out by this slide, which is that there is a constraint or a limit put on how big a cell can grow in all three dimensions. And that constraint, the limit, so to speak, is because of what's called the surface area to volume ratio. Well, any ratio, mathematically, is just a fraction. It's one number divided by another, right? So surface area to volume ratio is just a cell's surface area value divided by its volume value. And just to make it easier to think about as the math, we're using a cube to represent a single cell here. The small one with the one with the number one by it means that it is one unit on each in each dimension. One unit high, one unit deep, one unit wide. The units aren't shown because they really don't matter. It can be any unit you want. But right now, this is a cell this size. Well, how do you compute the surface area of this? It's a cube. What is the area of each face? It's one by one, right? So each of these faces is one square unit, whatever unit you're using. But there's six identical faces. So the total surface area is therefore six square units. Does that make sense? That's where this six comes from. The volume, though, is one by one by one. In other words, one cubic unit of volume. That's where this one comes from. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. All right? Now, let's grow that cell in all three dimensions at the same time. And let's grow it 5 times as big in all three dimensions. So 5 times as tall, 5 times as wide, 5 times as deep to get this bigger cube. And let's look what happens to the values. Now each face is 5 by 5, or 25 square units. So the total surface area is 6 times that, which is 150 square units. The volume is 5 times 5 times 5, which is 125 square units. I mean cubic units. And look what happened to the surface area to volume ratio. Yes, both the surface area got big and the volume got bigger, but the surface area to volume ratio, 150 divided by 125, is now only 1.2, which shows you that as a cell gets bigger in all three dimensions, its surface area to volume ratio goes down. And this is why cells cannot get indefinitely big. There is a limit. Now, it should make sense that, mathematically, it should make sense that surface area to volume ratio goes down because area is to the second power, right? So y equals x squared is a parabola. If you just look at the positive values, it looks like that. Y equals x cubed, which is volume, also increases, but it increases much more steeply. It gets big a lot faster than area does. And so what's happening is that when a cell grows in all three dimensions, its volume outgrows its surface area. The reason why that is a limit to how big a cell can get is that in order to remain alive, any cell has to continuously exchange materials with the surroundings. Has to bring certain things in, has to get rid of certain things, or it will die. Well, where does that exchange of materials with the environment take place? At the surface. And the bigger the volume you have, the more you have to get into and out of that cell to keep it alive. Eventually, there will be a time where you don't have enough surface to make enough exchange to service that bigger volume. So cells don't get big in all three dimensions. Now, in your body, you have some extraordinarily long cells. There is a single neuron, for instance, that runs all the way from the base of your spinal cord to your toe. That's one cell, very long in one dimension, but it's still microscopically small in the other two dimensions. So it doesn't have a big volume. It still has a very high surface area. But you can't have a human-sized cell because of the constraint put on by surface area to volume ratio. Therefore, there are large organisms like us, but not large unicellular organisms. We get big by being multicellular. That's represented by this multicellular, this many cubes, it represents a multicellular organism here, that has just as big a body as this middle 5 by 5 by 5 cube, but by making its body out of a bunch of 1 by 1 by 1 cubes, each cell individually still has a high surface area to volume ratio and can remain alive. Now we get to 5, and as far as slides are concerned, it's going to slow down a little because it takes me a while to get through this one, but then it'll speed back up. This is another catch-all slide. Not every cell is going to look like this, but this is an animal cell that we're looking at. And it's colorized. These aren't the actual colors that these things are, of course, but it helps to talk about them individually by having them different colors. I guess we might as well start with the thing that makes this cell eukaryotic. It's an animal cell. All animals are eukaryotics, right? Or eukaryotic organisms. So it shouldn't surprise you at this point that It has a nucleus. An animal is a eukaryote. Eukaryotic cells have a true nucleus. That's the purple thing. And the fact that it's a true nucleus means that it has its own membrane that encloses it, unlike the nucleoid of a prokaryotic cell. Well, not only is the nucleus a membrane-bounded organelle, but it is the first of three organelles that I will mention that are multiply membrane-bounded. And you can kind of see it depending on where you're sitting. Not only is there a membrane here around this nucleus, there are actually two membranes. And so it's a double membrane, but double membrane means two separate bilayers. In other words, there's four layers of phospholipids because it takes two layers of phospholipids just to make one membrane, right? Then there's another separate membrane. So there's an outer nuclear membrane and inner nuclear membrane. Together, both of them make up what is called the nuclear envelope. And another thing you see on the surface that's rising above the horizontal part in pink is that the surface of the nuclear envelope is studded with complexes of proteins. That's what the pink things are. And those complexes of proteins are organized to make them be like little tunnels. These are nuclear pores, which are important because the nucleus is its own compartment within the cell, separated by the nuclear envelope from the stuff outside of it, which is the cytoplasm. And certain things happen in the nucleus, certain other things happen out in the cytoplasm, but certain things that have to be in both places, not at the same time, of course, but they have to spend time in both places, need to be able to get through the nuclear envelope, and that's what the nuclear pores are for. The most important example, and really the only one we'll discuss in this course, is messenger RNA, which I've only briefly touched on. We'll get into much greater detail on that later. But in the previous chapter, when I talked about the fact that DNA is used to create or to tell the cell how to create messenger RNA, which is then used to tell the cell how to create a polypeptide, in other words, the process of gene expression, which includes transcription and translation. Well, in a eukaryotic cell, transcription occurs in the nucleus because transcription involves DNA, and that's where the DNA is. The messenger RNA, though, then has to meet up with a ribosome in order for translation, which is the assembly of the polypeptide, to take place. And those ribosomes are out in the cytoplasm. So the messenger RNA that gets created in the nucleus needs to then be exported out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. That's what the nuclear pores are for. Within the nucleus, and by the way, everything in the nucleus is separate from the cytoplasm, as I was saying earlier, and therefore it gets its own name. This is not cytoplasm in the nucleus, it's nucleoplasm, the stuff of the nucleus. And in the cutaway view of the nucleus here, you can see that there is chromatin in here, as it's labeled. Chromatin is a combination of two major categories of molecules. Chromatin is the stuff that chromosomes are made out of. I'm sure you've heard of chromosomes, maybe not chromatin, though. And we'll study chromosomes in a different chapter, in a different unit. But what chromatin is DNA complexed with a bunch of proteins. And those proteins are called histone proteins. Don't worry about that right now, but histones plus DNA make up chromatin, and that's the stuff you see in the nucleus for a eukaryotic cell, of course. Be careful with this word nucleolus. That's not nucleus. This whole purple thing is the nucleus. The nucleolus is a region within the nucleus, this darker region within the nucleus. And the nucleolus is the place in a eukaryotic nucleus at which RNA versions other than messenger RNA are produced. The only kind of RNA I've talked about so far is messenger RNA, but there are all kinds of other RNA types, and those are produced at the nucleolus. Now, when you look right here at this outer nuclear membrane, which is purple, like the rest of the nucleus, you see that right here, but also other places not shown in the picture, here and there, the outer membrane will fold outward, and it changes into blue because that even though it's the same membrane, it's continuous membrane, when it folds out, it becomes part of a separate membrane-bounded organelle. All this blue material is a separate organelle, but it's connected by membrane to the nucleus. And all of that blue organelle collectively is called the endoplasmic reticulum. But notice the bracket there under the word endoplasmic reticulum. There are two major parts to this single organelle, the so-called rough endoplasmic reticulum and smooth endoplasmic reticulum. They not only look different from each other, although they're connected, it's the same organelle, they also have different jobs. The reason that the rough ER got its name, which is all this part that looks like flattened sacs, it's really just a highly folded membrane. But the reason it got called rough ER is that under light microscopy, what gives it the roughness are all of these brown dots, which are the same thing that the brown dots were in the prokaryotic slide. Those brown dots are ribosomes. Now, ribosomes are their own organelle. And these ones just happen to be, at the moment, associated with the rough ER. But that's what gives it its rough appearance. Now, that makes sense when you consider the job of the rough ER. The major function of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made polypeptides. Not all polypeptides need modification after they're built, but some do. Well, the organelles that are responsible for building polypeptides to begin with are ribosomes. And that's why it makes sense for all these ribosomes to be associated with the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, because these polypeptides that they're assembling one amino acid at a time, these polypeptides are being threaded into the hollow interior. And a word that means that is lumen. They're being threaded into the lumen of the rough ER so that they can then be modified right after they're made by the rough ER. Depending on the protein, the rough ER will get a signal as to what kind of thing needs to be done, but it's on a per protein basis as to what the actual modification is. That's the major job of the rough ER. Part of the same organelle, part of the same membrane system, is this part over here that looks more like a network of tubes. That's the smooth ER. And it's smooth because it doesn't have these ribosomes attached to it, and that's because its job is totally different. The major job of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is to produce lipids. But it's also a storage container for various things, including calcium ions. Calcium ions are major chemical signals in cells. This is a major part of the long string of events that takes place to make your muscles contract. And so when a muscle is not contracting, when it's at rest, those calcium ions are pumped into the smooth ER to keep them from causing muscle contraction. When a signal is reached, though, it starts out in your brain. When it reaches the muscle cells, the smooth ER will release those calcium ions into the general cytoplasm, and they interact with proteins and cause muscle contraction. All right, now, if it weren't for the fact that these are colorized, you would probably not even recognize this next organelle, the one in teal. And that, it goes by several names. It's called either the Golgi apparatus, as it's labeled here, or the Golgi complex. Some books will just call it the Golgi. Golgi is a dead Italian that it's named after. But it's the reason that you would mistake it easily for a rough ER is that it has similar appearance. It's a folds in membrane that make it look like flattened sacs. Well, it makes sense that it is situated right next to the rough ER because these two organelles, rough ER and Golgi complex, cooperate. Functionally speaking, the Golgi complex has the major job of acting more or less as a receiving and shipping center, just like those centers in a factory. Usually in different places of the factory building or complex, right? There's a receiving center somewhere, which is where trucks deliver things to that factory. And then there's a shipping center somewhere else on the same building where other trucks pick things up produced by the factory and take them to their proper destination. That's exactly what the Golgi does on a much smaller scale. So what happens is that the product of the rough ER, which are little packages of these now modified polypeptides that got modified by the rough ER, are sent to the nearby Golgi complex. It takes those packages of modified proteins in and then on a per protein basis figures out where they need to go, and then sends them out to the appropriate destination. Let's just continue working clockwise. Next we see a lysosome. It looks just like a little sac. The name, well, the some part of the name, as in soma or somatic, means body. Lyse, as in hydrolysis, means split. So this is a word that means splitting body. It is a membrane-bounded organelle because the little sac that you see is made out of membrane material. And, by the way, membrane material is moving around all the time in a cell. Membrane material that starts out in the Golgi, that starts out in the rough ER becomes part of the Golgi, and so on, and it could become part of the plasma membrane. So the membrane material at any given moment is part of a membrane-bounded organelle, but it might be the next moment as part of another organelle. It gets moved around, and membrane material easily fuses with other membrane material because even if they're from different organelles, they're made of the same stuff, basically, which is phospholipid bilayer mostly, and some proteins and other things thrown in there. Well, that's true for the membrane material that makes up a lysosome. But the reason that these things are called lysosomes, or splitting bodies, is that they house hydrolytic enzymes. In other words, enzymes that are responsible for the job of hydrolysis reactions. Hydrolytic is just the adjective of hydrolysis. And we've already talked about hydrolysis reactions. What happens in a hydrolysis reaction? This is the boring part of the recording when no one answers. What does a hydrolysis reaction accomplish? Exactly. Some bigger thing is split into smaller things in a hydrolysis reaction. That's why it's called a splitting body. Well, enzymes that help out are hydrolytic enzymes. And a hydrolytic enzyme is therefore a dangerous thing to have around, because you want it to split apart only the things that need to be split apart. Hydrolytic enzymes could split apart other things, like the integrity of the cell, the parts of the cell. So these dangerous enzymes are safely put into these little packets of membrane called lysosomes, and therefore inside that lysosome, the things that should be split apart can be split apart, keeping the enzymes safely away. Okay, let's go. Keep going clockwise. Mitochondrion is next, and that's a singular word. There are multiple mitochondria shown here, though. Singular is mitochondrion, plural is mitochondria. This is the second example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. So the orange bean-shaped things here are mitochondria. And you can see both membranes even in this catch-all picture. The major job of a mitochondrion is a complex set of reactions that we'll study in Unit 3, collectively called cellular respiration. So we'll look at the details later, but the purpose of cellular respiration is to maximize the amount of energy that can be stored or extracted from fuel. So it drastically increases the efficiency of using fuel. All right, now peroxisome is listed next. And this looks very similar to a lysosome, even more similar if you looked at it in a real cell, because they wouldn't be colorized. But the reason it gets its own name is because it has its own function. It's similar to a lysosome. It gets rid of some, it splits something apart, but it's called a peroxisome because it breaks down peroxides and other potentially harmful materials that collectively are called reactive oxygen species, or just ROS for short. Another name for reactive oxygen species are oxidants, oxidizing agents, which just get created as a normal part of metabolism. There's really nothing we can do about having them occur in cells, but they can be damaging. They are oxidizing agents, which means they oxidize other things. Well, when you oxidize things, you can damage it. This is why, you know, nutritionists make such a big deal about antioxidants. Antioxidants are things in food that can help take care of these oxidants that get created. But we also have built-in steps to take care of the oxidants, and those are peroxisomes. Microvilli is listed next, and that's also a plural. Microvillus would mean one of these little finger-like projections, and that's what villus means. A microvillus is just a small version of a villus, but there are other villi in the body, like on your tongue, for instance. But this is a good example of something that not every cell would have, but this one happens to have them. Based on how they look, why would a cell want to have microvilli? What does that do for the cell? Can you tell just by the appearance? Well, if you think of this cutaway view, you see the edge of the plasma membrane? If you think of that as the beach around an island, And you had to walk from here to here. Well, from here to here, it's a pretty straight walk along the beach, right? But to go the same distance over here, but you have to stay on the beach, you're going to walk a hell of a lot more distance, right? Back and forth. And that's why these microvilli exist. It adds a lot more membrane without actually adding a bunch of volume, because half of this is outside of the sac, between the finger legs projections, is outside of the cell, not contributing to the cell's volume. So they're like folds in the plasma membrane that increase surface area. And that's why they will appear in cells that need extra surface area. A perfect example in your body is the endothelium, or the layer of epithelial cells that line the inner part of your small intestine. The small intestine is part of the digestive tract, or alimentary canal. And the main job of the small intestine is absorption. This is after digestion has occurred. We like to think that we put food into our bodies, but we don't do that really. The mouth is outside of your body, right? When I stick my finger in my mouth, my finger is still outside of my body. It's continuous with the air. Well, actually, the entire alimentary canal is outside of your body. The whole tube from mouth to anus, which is the alimentary canal, is really outside of your body, and your body wraps around it. So we put food into that tube that's still outside of our body, and that food is made up of large molecules, the macromolecules we've been talking about. Those are too big to get into the cells of the body. So that's why you first have to digest the food, which involves enzymes breaking these macromolecules into the monomers, the small molecules that those macromolecules are made out of. So fats get broken into glycerol and fatty acids, proteins get broken into amino acids, and so on. Those are then small enough to get put into your body, and that happens at the small intestine. That means that those small molecules need to pass through the plasma membrane of those cells lining the small intestine, and that requires the help of proteins that are embedded in the plasma membrane. Therefore, the more membrane you have, the more of those helpful proteins that transport these things into the cells can be put, which is important because everything's moving through you, right? And we've evolved since, for most of human history, food was scarce and humans were on the brink of starvation. We've evolved to maximize the efficiency of absorption. So we have a lot of membrane on those cells. So a lot of proteins can be housed in there, and we can bring in as much of those nutrients as is possible before it's lost through the other end. But there's other examples as well. It just all boils down to requiring more surface area. All right, now the next thing in all caps here is cytoskeleton, which linguistically means the skeleton of the cell. It's not a bony skeleton that is hard, like our endoskeleton made out of bone, but it is a framework, just like the endoskeleton is. So it is part of the organization in a cell. Never think of a cell as being a bag of stuff that's sloshing around randomly. It is very highly dynamic, so it's always changing. But it's also very highly ordered. Things are where they're supposed to be. And a big reason is because you have a cytoskeleton to keep things in order. As far as structural elements are concerned, the cytoskeleton is made out of three major categories of protein fibers. And that's why under the all caps, you have those three listed. Microfilaments, intermediate filaments, microtubules. The easiest to see in this picture are the microtubules, which are these yellow fibers. And I'll talk more about those in a different slide, as well as the other filaments. But notice that these microtubules are connected to this yellow region. And I'm not talking about the T-shaped thing here. I'm talking about this kind of yellow aura that's here. That yellow region is called the centrosome. A centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. So that's where these microtubules grow from. They get longer and longer as they grow from the centrosome. Later on in this same cell's life cycle, there will be two centrosomes. And another major job of the centrosomes, when there's two of them, is to allow for division of the nucleus into two. This is part of cell division in eukaryotes. That nuclear division is called mitosis, and we'll study that later. But centrosome is not pointing to, the word here is not pointing to this T-shaped thing. It's pointing to the yellowness around the T. All right, now the T itself is made of two what look like pieces of licorice. Those are protein complexes, and those two that make up this T are called centrioles. And all I can really tell you about centrioles is that animal cells, centrosomes, have centrioles. But we haven't figured out what they do, really. Now, other eukaryotes besides animals also have centrosomes for the same reason, but those other groups of organisms don't have centrioles in their centrosomes. And so there is almost certainly something important about the centrioles, but we don't know yet. Oh, this one is also has a flagellum. This is another example of something that is not on every animal cell. In fact, it's fairly rare for an animal cell, a flagellum. But what's a good example for humans of a cell with a flagellum? Right, a sperm cell is a flagellated cell, has a flagellum, because a sperm needs to make, in terms of its body length, a hell of a long swim if it's going to get up the vagina, through the uterus, through the fallopian tube, until it finally meets an egg to fertilize it. That's a lot of body length for a microscopically small sperm, and it allows it to propel itself through that. All right, that is that picture. Let's go on to 6 now, and we're confronted with a similar-looking picture. But I don't have to spend as much time on this because there's a lot of repeats. This is a plant cell, and an animal cell and a plant cell are the only ones that we're looking at. I just don't want you to get the idea that those are the only two important groups of eukaryotes. There's fungi and there's protists. There's all kinds of eukaryotes. They'll have most of these as well, but animals and plants are two biggies. Now, there's a couple reasons that we can tell this is a plant cell and not an animal cell, and that's because a plant cell will have just about everything an animal cell has, but additional things that animal cells don't have. One thing that's pretty conspicuous that plant cells have and animal cells don't is a cell wall. So that's the brown material, and notice the thickness, much more thick than the flimsy yellow plasma membrane. Once again, every cell that's ever existed has a plasma membrane. We animal cells have plasma membrane, and that's the only covering, though. A plant cell has a plasma membrane, and then exterior to that, a much thicker and stronger cell wall. Just like you saw for the prokaryotic slide, it's just that plants make their cell walls out of a different material compared to bacteria. But it's for the same reason, to hold in pressure. It's a strong material. Okay, another thing that is pretty conspicuous in this figure is this huge-looking central vacuole. Now, central makes sense. It's right in the middle of the cell. Vacuole is a little bit of a misnomer because vacuous means empty. A vacuum is emptiness. And that's why it got its name. Vacuole implies that this thing is empty. It's not actually empty. It just looks like there's nothing in it under a light microscope. But what's in it is mostly water. Now, there can be other things in there as well. For instance, certain pigments can be put into there by the cell. And also, just about anything else a plant wants to dump into there. So the central vacuole can be kind of used like a dump. It's its own compartment, since it's membrane-bounded. And therefore, if the cell wants to put something in there to get it away from the cytoplasm so it doesn't interfere with things, it can put it into the central vacuole. A vacuole and a vesicle are really the same thing. They're bags of membrane, but vacuole is a bigger version. A vesicle is a smaller one, like a lysosome or a peroxisome that we looked at earlier. Another thing to say about the central vacuole is that it can take up a huge portion of the volume of the cell. And this is one reason why plants, compared to animals, it depends on the species, can grow so quickly. You know, if you have a seedling, overnight it can grow an inch. Well, just like us animals, plants are multicellular, and they therefore get bigger by adding more cells. But it's a little bit easier for some plants to add more cells because they don't have to manufacture as much of the contents as animals do. That's because a lot of it is just the water that's in the central vacuole, and water is not created by the plant. It's just imbibed, taken in by the roots. So it can happen fairly quickly. All right, I'm not going to mention any of the things that I've already mentioned that animal cells have, but one thing that I haven't mentioned here that plants have and animal cells don't are these green organelles, which are the third of the three examples of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. These green ones are chloroplasts. And a chloroplast, functionally speaking, has the job of conducting a whole complex set of reactions separate from cellular respiration. And those reactions are called collectively photosynthesis. We'll also study photosynthesis in Unit 3. But for now, it's sufficient to say that photosynthesis is a complex set of reactions that allow the organism to produce organic compounds, which can be used for food and raw materials. But the important thing is that photosynthesis produces organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. Now, ecologically speaking, there are two major kinds of organisms in the world, and those are producers and consumers. All animals, including us, are consumers. Producers are the only kinds of organisms that can make organic molecules out of inorganic sources. And all of the consumers can't exist without producers because all organisms require organic compounds. But consumers can't make their own. Therefore, they have to either eat producers or eat consumers that eat producers or eat consumers that eat consumers that eat producers. It always goes back to producers. Plants aren't the only producers, and they aren't the first producers. The first producers were bacteria. But anyway, photosynthesis occurs in chloroplasts. Notice in this picture that a plant has chloroplasts and mitochondria. So a plant can undergo photosynthesis and cellular respiration. It can make its own food via photosynthesis and then use that food as fuel in its mitochondria for cellular respiration. We have mitochondria, so we can eat the plant and then use the fuel in our own mitochondria to get the energy out of it. Everything else, oh no, there's one thing I haven't mentioned here, which are the plasmodesmata. That's a plural word. The singular is simply plasmodesma. And so one of these little tunnel-like structures is one plasmodesma. And the tunnels go through the thickness of the cell wall material that's between cells. But notice the yellowness, which is the plasma membrane. Notice that each little plasmodesma tunnel is lined by plasma membrane material. This cell, this one cell whose interior we're looking at, is adjacent to many other cells all the way around it. We don't see those cells, but you can see part of their shape. This central cell, though, its plasma membrane folds outward and forms the lining of the plasmodesma and then will be continuous with the plasma membrane of the next cell, which means really all of the cytoplasm in a huge plant like a tree that has quadrillions of cells, all of that cytoplasm is really connected. Even though we call them separate cells, they're not truly separate from each other. They're all interconnected by these plasmodesmata. And these tunnels are examples of intercellular junctions, which simply means a place where two cells join. But since they're tunnels, that allows for intercellular communication. If it's just the right kind of particle, it can travel through a plasmodesma from one cell to the next, which is what communication is. So hormones, for instance, in plants travel through plasmodesmata. All right. Now the slides can go a little faster because most of these are just closer views of the things I've already gone through in the catch-all slides, starting with 7. This shows a better view of the nucleus and the rough endoplasmic reticulum, two separate organelles, as I was saying, but the reason it makes sense to put them both in one slide is about what I was saying as far as the membrane is concerned. The outer nuclear membrane has outfoldings here and there that become the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Changes color, not really, but in the book that I took this from, just to show you that it is now officially part of this other organelle. You still don't see much detail of the ribosomes. We'll look at those later, but you do get a better view of the nuclear pores. Each of these little nodules of the pink thing is a protein. So a bunch of proteins complexed in such a way that they form a hollow tunnel, make the nuclear pores. All right, now 8 shows you a better view of a ribosome. It's not just a brown dot now. It still doesn't show you much detail, but it does show you an important thing about a ribosome, which is that a single ribosome is made out of two ribosomal subunits, one of which is bigger than the other, and they have the very reasonable names, large subunit and small subunit. What is not true about this picture is that you would never see a small and large ribosomal subunit together without anything else being there. So really, in a cell, you have large subunits on their own, a bunch of copies, small subunits on their own, a bunch of copies. And only when messenger RNA comes along first and binds to a small subunit will a large subunit come and complete the ribosome. So ribosomes are modular devices, meaning they're made up of identical copies of subunits that these two might never see each other again. Any large subunit and any small subunit can be put together to form the functional ribosome. But what is the job, in one word, for a ribosome? What's the function? Translation, exactly. Remember the two jobs of DNA? No, transcription and replication. Transcription involves DNA, but its job is done once it hands off that code to the messenger RNA that gets produced in transcription. Now that messenger RNA is holding the code for how to build a protein. DNA's job is done at that point, and the messenger RNA needs to go find a ribosome, which is then responsible for reading the code in the messenger RNA to figure out how many amino acids and what kind of amino acids to string together in a particular sequence to form a polypeptide. That's the job of a ribosome. That assembly of the polypeptide, one amino acid at a time, is called translation. All right, now on the photomicrograph, you can see that there are things called free ribosomes and bound ribosomes. But don't be confused by that. They are actually exactly the same ribosomes. There's nothing different about them. In fact, the ones that are called bound ribosomes used to be free ribosomes. The difference, as far as the terminology is concerned, is that a free ribosome is not connected to a membrane at the moment. It's just on its own, free, in the cytoplasm. A bound ribosome means it's bound or tied to a membrane. And so you can see here that the membrane we're looking at, these dark streaks, is endoplasmic reticulum, specifically rough endoplasmic reticulum. And all of those ribosomes that are attached to the rough ER are only attached there at the moment. They're not permanent devices. Translation, which is what the ribosome accomplishes, that assembly of the polypeptide, always starts out on a free ribosome. And for some proteins, namely the proteins that aren't going to need to be modified after they're built, they start and end being built on a free ribosome. But then there's other polypeptides or proteins that are start being built on a free ribosome, and then the cell realizes this is one of those that need help afterward, need modification. So those ribosomes in the process of translation become associated with the membrane of the ER so that they can then finish that string of amino acids, that polypeptide, by putting it into the lumen of the rough ER so that it can then be modified by the rough ER. Once that's done, though, those bound ribosomes detach. And so you take a picture of the cell later on, it'll be a whole different set of ribosomes making up the roughness. Well, in, what is this, 8, 9, we see the same membrane material, nuclear envelope and rough ER. We see the ribosomes here making up the roughness, but the important thing shown here that you couldn't really see before is that once the job of the rough ER is done, meaning those proteins, whatever they are now modified, the rough ER needs to package those newly modified proteins in a little bit of membrane, a little sac made out of membrane, which is called a vesicle. Well, notice this is blue because this vesicle, the membrane of this vesicle, used to be part of the rough ER. A piece of the rough ER's membrane pinches off to form a vesicle that encloses that packet of newly made proteins to send it to the next organelle responsible. So where does it go from there? What organelle is going to receive that vesicle? The Golgi, exactly. Well, reasonably enough, slide 10 shows you the Golgi. And notice that this is still blue material here, indicating that this is a vesicle that budded off of the rough ER. The pink things here represent the polypeptides that are now modified, because it's already out of the ER. The modification has already been done. But it's membrane material, just like the membrane material in teal that makes up the Golgi. It's the same stuff. Therefore, when the vesicle reaches the membrane of the Golgi, it will fuse into it, like two oil droplets coalescing into one. And that will spill the cargo, these newly modified proteins, into the lumen of the Golgi. But this happens at one end. This input of material into the Golgi happens at one end. The Golgi is a polarized organelle, which has nothing to do with charge. Polar simply means there's two different ends. Remember, the Golgi's job is like a receiving and shipping center. So there's a receiving end that does only the receiving, and there's a shipping end. And they have names that should be familiar to you. The receiving end, which is the end that is right up against the rough ER that would be right here. The receiving end is called the cis face. And the shipping end at the other end, which is closer to the plasma membrane, is the trans face. So cis and trans, just like we talked about for geometric isomers. Cis means same side, trans means across, other side. All right, well, the vesicles are received and they become officially teal colored because they are now, for the moment, part of the Golgi. But the Golgi figures out where these need to go, and then they package them in, they put them in a new box, basically, made out of Golgi membrane material, which bubbles off of the trans face. And then those vesicles of modified proteins that now know where they're supposed to go, go to the appropriate place. There's three major mechanisms by which cells can get things into or out of themselves. And we'll talk about those more in lab today, actually. But one of those three is called vesicular transport. Which simply means transport into or out of a cell using a vesicle to get that thing, whatever it is, into or out of the cell. Not all transport into or out of a cell uses vesicles, but vesicular transport does. And that's a general term because all it tells you is that vesicles are involved. It doesn't tell you anything about what is being transported. It also doesn't tell you which direction it's being transported, either into or out. So there are two subsets of vesicular transport that are based on the direction in which something is being transported. Transport out of a cell is called exocytosis. Or I should say vesicular transport of something out of a cell is called exocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, exo means out. Inward vesicular transport is called endocytosis. Just the reverse process. Using a vesicle still, but you're bringing something in. Well, we then subdivide endocytosis into two subcategories based on what it is that's actually being brought in. One of those is phagocytosis, which you see in the picture here. The phago part of that means eat. So phagocytosis means the condition of cell eating. The cell isn't really eating, but it's by analogy with us eating food, which compared to drink is more solid stuff. So if a cell uses endocytosis to bring in solid chunks like this brown thing from the environment, that is phagocytosis, cell eating. The same thing can happen, though, forming a vesicle, but just basically taking a sip of the liquid that's around. And therefore, that is cell drinking, which is called pinocytosis. Pino means drinking. That's what's happening here. This is a something. This is a particle that has fuel in it, and so the cell is bringing it in by invaginating or infolding the plasma membrane to form the beginning of a vesicle, until it finally pinches off on the other side of the brown particle, and now all of a sudden the brown particle is in the cell. But notice that it never went through a membrane. So compared to the other two that I haven't mentioned yet, ways in which you can get things into or out of cells, vesicular transport kind of cheats. It's a way of getting things into or out of cells without those things actually going through plasma membrane. But that forms this food vacuole, which is made a sack of membrane material. And notice that a lysosome here, containing those dangerous enzymes, is made of the same stuff, membrane material, so they confuse together, and that will then expose the hydrolytic enzymes to the thing that you want to split apart, the food particle, safely away from the rest of the cell. On B, a similar thing is happening. You're using a lysosome to break apart something. But in this case, it's not actually food being brought in from the environment. It is a part of the cell itself. So this vesicle here contains a mitochondrion. But this is not a functional mitochondrion. It's a worn-out one, seen better days, is no longer functioning. So it's useless as far as cellular respiration is concerned, the job of the mitochondrion. It can no longer work again. But it's made of a bunch of valuable materials. Just like a junkyard recycles things, this autophagy, which means self-eating, means that this valuable stuff, if you break it into the monomers it's made out of, can then be used to build new stuff. Now to 12. No new information here. You just get a better view of the central vacuole and this real picture on the bottom right. Shows you just how much of the volume of the cell can be occupied by just water, which is why I was saying plants can grow quickly. And 13 isn't really all new material either, but one bit of information is shown that you didn't see before. Once the vesicles bud off of the Golgi, and so the Golgi has already figured out where this modified protein needs to go, one possibility is that it could go somewhere else in the cell. Another possibility is that those proteins need to go fully out of the cell. They need to be exported. And the third possibility is that they need to be put into the plasma membrane. These ones happen to be ones that need to go out of the cell to work in the extracellular part. And so when the vesicle melds with the plasma membrane, that former Golgi teal-colored membrane material is now part of the plasma membrane. Membrane material is always moving around from organelle to organelle. And notice that will spill all of these modified proteins into the extracellular space. That, by the way, is exocytosis. Using a vesicle to put something out of the cell, and notice it never went through a membrane. Brings us to 14, a much better view of a mitochondrion. Remember, it's multiply membrane bounded. It has two membranes, and those are descriptively called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. The outer mitochondrial membrane is really just a smooth covering, so it's just as big as it needs to be to cover the inner membrane. The inner membrane, even though it's inside of that, is actually much bigger. And that's because the inner mitochondrial membrane has many folds in it. Each fold is called a crista, the plural of which is Christi. There are many Christi in the inner membrane. So why would a mitochondrion have these Christis? Christi.
Well,
Exactly. Just like a microvillus increases surface area, so do Christie. They drastically increase the surface area of the inner mitochondrial membrane. And as we'll look at later in cellular respiration, for cellular respiration to occur requires a bunch of proteins that are embedded in the inner membrane. Therefore, the more inner membrane you have, the more proteins that can be housed there, and the more fuel can be processed efficiently in the process of cellular respiration. Another important thing about this fact that it's a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, though, is that even though the mitochondrion as a whole is a separate compartment compared to the cytoplasm, since it's multiply membrane-bounded, the mitochondrion itself is subcompartmentalized. There are two membranes, so there are two compartments in a mitochondrion. One compartment, which is fluid-filled, is the compartment that's between the two membranes, between the outer and the inner membrane, and that's called the intermembrane space, the space between the membranes. But you also have a fluid interior that's fully inside the inner membrane, and all of that stuff collectively is called the mitochondrial matrix. And by the way, the two fluid environments, matrix and intermembrane space, are chemically distinct. They're not the same exact stuff. You also see here that a mitochondrion has its own ribosomes, which are separate from the ribosomes in the cytoplasm that we looked at earlier. And there's an important reason. There's important things I want to say about that, but I'm not going to finish it in time, so I'll start next time by talking about what I'm talking about, by talking about what I'm thinking about that you don't know yet. I'll see you downstairs.